Good morning.
Good morning, Sensei.
Just a quick aside before I give my talk. When I was leaving this morning, I was going down the steps in the front, and the rain gutter had a leak in it. Not a big leak, but enough to just have the drop falling down. And laying on the ground was a piece of mail advertisement or something. And as the water fell down and it hit the paper, it had its unique sound, right? But there was like... And, you know, in that moment, that sound was so beautiful. Just a simple drip. And that's the Dharma. It doesn't have to be a big whoop. You know, you don't have to have teachers walking on water and all that stuff. Just a simple drop onto a piece of paper is the Dharma. So today's talk is going to be about Daisan. This is a talk that I repeat from time to time, especially lately we have a few new people. So I thought I would give this talk, not only for the new people, but for myself. It's a good reminder. Now, we use the word Daisan, that's the Daisan room back there, as a face-to-face meeting between the student and teacher. But there's two words that refers to that, Daisan and Dokusan. And they refer to the same space, the same activity. But Daisan is used if a student or a Sangha member goes to meet with a sensei. If a Daisan member or a student goes to visit a Roshi, then we use the word Dokusan. Now, the history of this goes back to Zen in India. And originally, Daisan was a face-to-face meeting between a Sangha member, a student, but it was really a philosophical conversation. And then as Daisan, as this practice, Daisan or Dokusan, moved to China, it really started to focus on a student's direct experience of Zen practice. And it became an opportunity to discuss Zazen, work with a koan, or just simply to sit in silence together. Whatever it is that arises, right, there's no transcript to follow. What is it that arises in that moment when we sit there together? Now, somebody, I don't know where I got this from, but somebody likened this experience of Daisan as a chick pecking from inside of the egg and the hen pecking from the outside of the egg. So it's the teacher and student who are working together, in essence, to break through the shell of delusion. And when that happens, we realize who we also are. We're not just who we think we are, but we discover who we also are. Now, some practical things for people who come to Daisan, whether it's here or with any teacher. And this is regarding the nature of the relationship. The parties should always maintain clear boundaries and a respectful confidentiality. And this, of course, is vital to creating a close relationship between student and teacher. And Daisan may last a few seconds, or it may last 10 minutes. But the time should not be used as an indication of how successful or not successful the Daisan was. Meeting between the student and teacher has nothing to do with success or failure. In true Daisan, true Dokusan, there is no such thing as success or failure. The real spirit of Daisan, the real spirit of this encounter, is the learning to surrender to the unknown. Right? We sit across from each other, and so what's going to happen? It's unknown. We don't know. But it takes care of itself. We don't have to manage anything. Just be there. And if you have a question, just see what happens when you ask that question. Or if something happens in your daily life, how does that relate to our practice? And so in Daisan, we sit fully in each moment, each present moment, together. So how does Daisan fit into the overall process of Zen practice? In this lineage, the white plum lineage, students are required to enter or to pass through several gates or stages. And the first gate is when a student makes the decision to start practice and actually goes to a zendo to begin. This is a step into the unknown that I just mentioned and can require a fair amount of courage. I know in the beginning of Zen, I didn't want to go to Zazen. I was a coward. I was afraid. And I say that lightly, you know, I'm not being harsh to myself, but, you know, it was this big unknown, and I was worried about being vulnerable, and could I trust the person on the other side of that door? But that's the first step, you know, to take that step, get off the cushion, and step into the room. The second stage, or gate, is receiving instruction in Zazen and the protocol of the Zendo, which is practical. Many students have questions about that. You know, why do we follow these rituals? Why does everybody have to do this, the same thing in the same way? Good questions. The third gate is beginning a daily practice, both at home and at the Zendo. And daily practice is very important, even if you can only sit for 10 minutes. If you can find a space in your day, every day, to sit for 10 minutes, right, that gate of making a commitment. And sometimes it's helpful to set up an altar, a little space that's devoted to the practice of Zazen. The fourth gate is making a financial commitment within the student's means to support the practice, within your means. Right? But it's also important to take that step because, again, it's a commitment to the practice. There's a symbolic part of that. And the word that we use for that is dana, D-A-N-A, which means giving. It's also a way of stepping outside of ourselves, right? Because giving is leaving ourselves and going outward. And that's very similar to compassion. And then the fifth gate, and probably the most profound one, is establishing this relationship with a teacher. And this relationship is cultivated in Daisan, and it's unique to Zen. And it's considered, again, one of the most important aspects of Zen practice. So these are the five gates. And put together, this is the heart of this practice. Now, particularly in the West, Zen, the fundamental, the bottom line to Zen is, who are you? Right? Who am I? And so that has a particular way, a particular path to answer that question. Right? Who am I? But another way to answer, who am I, is the psychotherapeutic way, right? Which has a different meaning. But these two are not separate. But it's important to understand the difference, right? Many students come to Zen because they're suffering in some way. And in many ways, the practice can help with that suffering, can help see clearly who is it that's suffering. And why is that suffering taking place? Many times the suffering takes place because we're clinging, because life is impermanent, and so on. But other students come because they have psychological issues in their life or social difficulties. Now, the practice can help with that in the sense that we can learn to sit and be centered. You know, the practice of counting the breaths is that we count one on an in-breath, two on an out-breath, three on an in-breath. You know, so it's... And then if you just look at me for a second, what happens is, eventually, you know, sometimes we don't get past one, but we start to lose the breath, and we fall over into thinking. Right? And then the instruction is, when you realize that, you just bring yourself back. Right? So that constant coming back, is teaching us to be centered. So if we have something upsetting in our lives, something that activates something from when we're younger, one of the ways that our practice can help us with that is it keeps us centered. Right? We don't stay knocked over by this. And by being centered, it gives us a much better place to do that psychological work. Now, another thing that Daisan can do, even if we're not going to practice psychotherapy, we can tell our story and have somebody bear witness to that story. You know, many times, I'll include myself in this, we keep our stories to ourselves. We carry them around. And it's really a relief, and it has been for me, to have a place where I can tell my story and know that the person that's listening is listening and is not making judgments. Now, this issue of psychological versus spiritual, you don't have to look very far at how many teachers in the West, and pretty much all men, have fallen from grace because enlightenment did not heal certain wounds that they carried that would allow them to break that boundary. Now, another thing that happens in relation to this is that meditation itself, when we sit quietly, we can notice things about ourselves that we don't necessarily notice when we're moving busily in the world. Things pop up. We see things that we have pushed down and have not paid attention to for a long time. Now, in one way, that can be painful, but in another way, it creates an opportunity to look into that and find a way or ways to heal that, especially if it interferes with our life. Even the fact that we're not paying attention to it can interfere with our life. Now, just quickly, because I've shared this story before, but because of my childhood, I made a commitment to myself as a child to never allow myself to be vulnerable, and almost a literal commitment. And I did that because that was the only safe way I could live in that family. So time passes, and then I become an adult, and I'm no longer living in that family. And so I find Zen practice. And at a retreat, about the fourth or fifth day into a retreat, when, you know, usually you get really quiet, it's hard to describe this, but the sense of who I was, you know, things started to drop away, and it terrified me. And it terrified me because it was a very vulnerable experience. That spiritual experience activated in me an old psychological wound. And I realized that if I was going to go deeper in this practice, if I was really going to surrender to the practice, that I had to go and take care of this. And Daisan wasn't going to do that, and Zazen wasn't going to do that. I needed to step over to the other side. But remember, these are two sides of the same person. They're not in opposition. They're not separate, really. We talk about them separately because it helps. It's a way to deal with it. But at the same time, it's one. Right? Psychotherapy and Zazen are one. They're two different expressions of the same person, two different sides of the same person. So I think that a teacher has the responsibility, when being with a student and this sort of thing comes up, to help the student be clear whether or not Daisan is the place to do it or a therapist's office is the place to do it. And again, it's tricky. You know, sometimes it's okay to go a little bit further from the Zazen point of view. And sometimes it's not, particularly if you're going to open that can of worms and you only have 5 minutes or 10 minutes, right? That's really a disservice to the student. So I find personally that, you know, it's important to be careful not to allow too much to open up if I can't be there, right? If the system, the setup isn't conducive to that. So if that happens, you know, it's not meant as insensitivity. It's not intended to be that way. It's because I would think, and I think most teachers would think, it's the best way to serve a student. So it doesn't mean you can't come in and talk about your life, because Zen is life. Right? So there's no hard and fast rule about this. You know, if you think it's helpful, we'll bring it up, and then together we can decide whether it's a good idea or not. So I'm not saying this to inhibit anybody, but just to clarify, because in the West it's different than in the East. So this relationship that takes place in Zazen has to be based on trust and mutual respect. And like any good relationship, it will deepen over time. And this student-teacher relationship should encourage confidence, freedom, independence in the student. Never should the student surrender their own judgment to the authority of a teacher. It's important to be prepared to say no, to be freestanding and to trust yourself. And I say that because what I just mentioned, what's happened in the practice, in spiritual practices, not just Zen, where teachers have taken advantage of students. And I think what happens a lot of times is we elevate teachers, whether it's in this kind of practice or any other kind of practice, right? But really, it's just two human beings hanging out. And so, please, whether it's here or anywhere, if you're with a teacher, trust yourself. Be your own self. Don't surrender your power or whatever word you want to use for that to any teacher. Now, if you build a relationship with a teacher, of course we can be vulnerable because we've tested that slowly over time. But I'm saying all of this because Daisan is a place that should feel safe and should encourage openness. It should encourage you to come in and decide to talk about anything you want to talk about. And then between the teacher and the student, we can decide whether it's going to be helpful here or not. So the basic process here is, you know, we sign up on the sheet that's over there on the shoe rack. And then you make it, you know, try and remember the order in which, you know, like whether you're second or third or fourth. And, you know, if there's confusion, don't worry about it. Jeff's here to help out, make sure the flow is okay. So when you leave to go to Daisan, you do a bow, you get up, you bow to the altar. Right? Anytime you cross in front of the altar, you bow. So you're going to cross in front of the altar, so you bow to the altar as well. And then you go in, and you'll know when to go in because I'll ring a bell. And then when you arrive in there, I'll be standing, and then you just stand opposite of me, and then we bow to each other. Right? We bow to this partnership that we're about to begin. And then we both sit down, we do another little bow, and then the conversation, whatever that is. Now, as I said before, Daisan is to serve the student. So Daisan could last 30 seconds, and either the bell rings or the teacher, I'll say thank you. But again, that's not a measure of success or failure in Daisan. It's sort of my role is to see how can I serve you best. And sometimes I can serve you best by ending the session in 30 seconds. And then, as I said, other times not. It all depends. So then we sit and we meet each other. And it's not necessarily in a conventional way. It depends. Or it may start out in a conventional way and it may turn to a different way. Ways that are designed to help you answer the question, who is it that is brushing their teeth this morning? Who is it that's in that mirror? So then when Daisan ends, typically the teacher will use the bell. I don't really do that often, but I might do that. Or I might just put my hands together in gassho and say thank you. And then we know that the Daisan is over. And then we bow to each other, stand up, bow to each other again, and then the student leaves. Well, just because this is important and because we do have some new folks, does anybody have any questions?
You have to be a formal student.
You have to be a formal student. No, anybody can come. That's something. I'm glad you asked that question. Anybody can come, any member of the Sangha. Some people, after a while, after that relationship, will become a student. It's a more formal relationship. I think in some places the student actually writes out a formal request to become a student. But it's a different kind of commitment to practice, because what you're saying is, I'm making this commitment to practice, and I'm making this commitment to working with this particular teacher, and I'm making this commitment to come into Daisan as much as absolutely possible, not just because on a particular day there's something that I want to work with. So it's a difference, and there's no right way or there's no wrong way. It's based on your temperament. I practiced Zen for years and didn't have a teacher. And then I met Roshi Kennedy, who is my teacher, who I just felt this was the place to make this commitment and work with him directly in that way, regularly getting up twice a week at 4:30 in the morning to go do that. Now, that's a commitment that I made to the practice and to working with my teacher. Okay? Okay. Thank you.